Spirit Catholic Radio, KVSS. We are Catholic Radio for the Christian community. Welcome again to Spirit Mornings with Bruce McGregor and
Chris McGregor.
And always a pleasure to have with us, Chris, Dr. Matthew Bunsen. He is a senior fellow of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology and one of the United States' leading authorities on the papacy and the church. Author of many books, Dr. Bunsen, since 1997, has served as general editor of our Sunday Visitor's Catholic Almanac, the largest compendium of facts and statistics on the Catholic Church, and also one of our favorite, one of his more recent books, John Paul II's Book of Saints.
I love it.
Yeah. Dr. Bunsen also serves as a consultant to MSNBC, NBC News, CBS Radio, and the BBC, as well as other media outlets. And we're delighted to have him back with us today. Dr. Bunsen, thanks.
Hello. It's a great pleasure to be with you, as always.
Well, we were going to talk, and we still will, about the Crusades and some different thoughts that people seem to have on it, what happened and what actually happened. But before we do that, I need to ask you, as, of course, the great Rome watcher that you are, your thoughts on the election of the new leader of the Jesuits.
Yeah, it was an interesting election to follow, at least from a distance. The 30th General Congregation of the Jesuits electing what is traditionally called the Black Pope, title that they give to the Master General of the Jesuit Order, the Society of Jesus. It's interesting to discuss briefly some of the lead-up to that, because Father Hans-Peter Kolvenbach chose to step down for a variety of reasons, which itself was unusual, because historically or traditionally, Master Generals have served until they die.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
What we're seeing, though, and what we did see in the lead-up to it, is, for example, Cardinal Frank Rutte, who's the prefect of the Congregation for Congregations, so the religious orders in the Church, issued some very strong statements to the Jesuits regarding a need to return to a lot of the traditional Jesuit attributes, so the characteristics of the Society of Jesus as it was founded by Ignatius Loyola. Namely, that there's clear fidelity to the teachings of the Church, and especially fidelity to the Holy See.
Mm-hmm.
Issues, I think, which have been raised over the last 30 or 40 years, some would say unfairly, some would say fairly, regarding the Society of Jesus. So the election, then, of a new Black Pope was watched very carefully by people. And the choice was one, I think, that took a number of people by surprise. We're talking, of course, about the Father Nicholas, the new Black Pope, and his background, though, is what I find most interesting, that he has served for many years, in Japan and Asia.
Mm-hmm.
He is a Spaniard by birth, studied at the Pontifical Gregorian University, which is, I always refer to it as the sort of the Harvard of the Catholic Church, if the Angelicum is the Yale University. The Gregorian is really the Harvard. It's the preeminent Jesuit school in the world. And he then went off to serve in the missions in East Asia and taught at the rather famous Sophia University in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
Then he also headed a pastoral institute in the Philippines, and then was also significantly the presiding secretary at the last of the General Congregations for the Jesuits in 1995. I'm aware of the fact that he speaks at least five languages.
Wow.
What does it signify? Well, what I think it shows is that the Jesuits are very clear about trying to find somebody who understands the difficulties facing the Church throughout the world, in particular, evangelizing and spreading the gospel in areas that aren't necessarily, or it would not appear to be, receptive to the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most challenging areas in the world today to proclaim Christ is in Asia, in part because you have such deep-seated Asian culture, you have such ancient religions and philosophies, everything from Shinto to Buddhism to Islam, throughout Asia. And crafting the way to evangelize, to enculturate the gospel in those environments, I think has been a real challenge in the years since the Second Vatican Council. And I think Father Nicholas is one of the great minds, some would say, in helping to do that while remaining at the same time faithful to what the Church teaches. Because there's been a lot of tension over the last decade or 20 years or so among some theologians, a few Jesuits, in going too far in trying to enculturate the gospel. And I think the brake has been put on a lot of these writings that, for example, argue that salvation doesn't necessarily have to come through the church, that salvation doesn't have to come through Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of this equalizing of religions, that no one religion is greater than the next, or that the church isn't necessarily required for salvation. Issues like this have been in the forefront of how we're going to proclaim the gospel in Asia and elsewhere. And I think Father Nicholas could be a good influence in keeping the line very clear about what we proclaim, what we believe, while at the same time offering a positive and optimistic and authentic vision for a part of the world that is hungering for the truth, but at times hasn't necessarily gotten it, or at times hasn't really been exposed to it.
Isn't it interesting they would go to a Spaniard by birth?
Yes. Comparisons have been made between Father Nicholas and one of his predecessors, the predecessor before Hans-Peter Kolvenbach, who's Dutch, I believe, Father Pedro Arrupe. Now, some would say that that's not exactly the comparison we want, because Father Arrupe was, in his time, a somewhat controversial figure in how he led the Jesuits. But the Spanish church, theologically especially, has been noted, especially in the last, in the years since the council, as one of the most solid areas in the church, especially in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So that background, the strong faith of the strength of the church in Spain, especially in its schools of theology and its theologians, I think provides a certain amount of counterbalance to some of the speculation and wandering off the reservation, to put it politely,
sure,
that you find in a lot of the European Catholic universities. So Spain, hopefully, just as it was the cradle for the evangelization of the New World, could very well prove, once again, to be the cradle for evangelization for Asia and elsewhere in this century. And we're certainly seeing that with Opus Dei, which has some strong universities there,
mm-hmm,
and the trust that the Holy Father has put in the Spanish cardinals. This last go-around, he named two new cardinals from Spain. A testament, I think, to the strength of the church in Spain in resisting also a lot of the secularizing tendencies that are going on in the country because of its recent election that ushered in a far-left government.
Yeah, interesting that given the fact that the founder of the order, of course, was St. Ignatius of Loyola, Spaniard, and also the missionary work of the great Francis Xavier in those countries where Father Nicholas is from and has been serving.
And one other thing to note, too, that he's 71, going on 72. Now, eyebrows were raised, certainly, at the age of someone who's running an organization of close to 18,000 priests around the world, but tens of thousands of Jesuit volunteers and institutions and schools and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
The stress of that work is considerable. But in a way, I think one of the things that they're looking at is that they see the Holy Father, who's now 80, clearly this is someone who has a great deal of energy. So they're going with experience, necessarily over youth and vigor. And there is, I think, especially given the complications of the church in the modern world, much to be said for wisdom over energy.
It will be very interesting to see the general effect that this will have over the next few years. I'm excited. I think it's a compelling and very interesting choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it is. The question is going to be how much support Father Nicholas will be receiving from elsewhere in the order. Also, what sort of long-term programs, because of his age, that he'll be able to introduce, and at the same time, what sort of internal reforms can come out of this general congregation. Much as we have seen in recent years, there has been a trend in so many of the religious orders and congregations toward, unfortunately, fad theological movements, everything from liberation theology now to eco-theology.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. While Pope Benedict XVI has stressed that the key for stewardship and maintaining the integrity of the earth, at the same time, we can't get caught up in a lot of these sort of postmodern theological trends.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing, Dr. Bunsen, we'll have you on the Rolodex as this continues to play forward. And Dr. Bunsen, we thought we would talk to you a little bit today about the Crusades. I think this is one of those topics that people hear so many different things about. And I would say that probably the phrase that pays when it comes to the Crusades is that misconceptions are all too common.
Absolutely. I can think back to what would be now almost 7 years ago to the horrendous events of 9/11. And sort of this crystallizing moment came when President Bush was giving this sort of off-the-cuff press conference. And he just did this throwaway line about the effort against the terrorists, Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And he said, this war, this crusade.
Oops.
And yeah. He meant nothing by it, particularly other than in the Eisenhower sense of crusade in Europe, that kind of thing. And, of course, the usual crowd went absolutely zooey over that use of the one word crusade. The New York Times, as I recall, fumed, and various people, such as James Carroll, the author of that infamous book, Constantine's Sword, scathing article, attacking the church and sort of dredging up again all of the myths and misconceptions and ideas that people have regarding the Crusades. And then, of course, there were numerous complaints from across the world from imams and Islamic religious leaders complaining that that the West has no right ever to, again, use the word crusade or to undertake one. So that right there, I thought, was a perfect example of why we need to have a better understanding of what actually went on with the crusade.
I'm excited because you are offering a course on Catholic Distance University, which is a great online resource for those who want to learn more about the Catholic faith and even earn potentially some credit towards whatever it is that you're studying.
Exactly.
And you are offering one on the truth on the Crusades.
Right. It's a several-week seminar, and it's available for graduates and undergraduates, and they all have the different requirements, as well as those people who just want to take it as a continuing education course. And the objective, and this is what I really was amazed when the Catholic Distance University asked me to teach this, the point is to try to offer people a real history of the Crusade. Now, what does that mean? I mean, we have to be upfront and perfectly blunt that the medieval warfare and the medieval age was a violent one.
Yeah.
So a lot of things happened in war that are pretty awful. Massacres took place, and at times, crusaders, without the blessing or permission of the church, did things that were certainly contrary to what we would now accept as perfectly normal actions in war. And misguided and bigoted Christians from the period did commit acts of atrocities, but also acts of anti-Semitism. One of the things that this seminar that we're trying to lay out for people is the fact that, again, all of these activities were done without the permission and the blessing of the church. And at the same time, we have to understand the wider context of the era and what the Crusaders were doing and why people thought the way they did. We can't look at so many of these events with the biased lens that we have today of political correctness. We have to understand the mind and the culture of that period.
Right.
And this, the point of the seminar is to introduce students to that. So we have a lot of primary readings. For example, we have William of Tyre and then Fulcher of Chartres, different writers and chroniclers of the period who expressed the view of that period. So hopefully the students will be coming away with a much clearer picture of what the world was like at the time. And then we'll also be concentrating, and this is, I think, the most fun part for me, on a lot of the myths and misconceptions that people have. Why did the Crusaders set off, for example, to try to reclaim Jerusalem? Was this simply a scheme on the part of the popes to acquire greater power? Was this set off by mad, greedy bishops and merchants who wanted to colonize and bring about the first of the West imperial ambitions and colonial ambitions in the Middle East? Questions like this that people actually hear all the time, that are easily debunked, but so many people, unfortunately, don't have access to the information to debunk them.
Right.
Well, Matthew, what really drove me crazy recently, well, not so recently, it was actually a couple years ago, I was watching a A&E presentation of a Terry Jones, who used to be with Monty Python, his mini-series, per se, of the Crusades. And while it was extraordinarily entertaining, the way that it was visually filmed and everything like that, I remember watching it and just screaming sometimes at the TV, just like, ah, because it's just, he would even put forth some of the just blatant errors of this time period, and yet no one challenges it, calls it into question. And the masses out there, the regular people watching this, are going, of course, this must be the way it was.
Right, and they're thinking, well, that makes sense. That of course, it would be kind of like that, wouldn't it? I mean, that people did things in the Middle Ages because they were ignorant and they were all bigots, and no one ever did anything really out of faith. Or if they did, it was horrendously misguided, or that they were being manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
I cringed, in fact, when I saw the very series that you're talking about, because Terry Jones, a legendary Monty Python membership, really can't do anything that isn't pretty funny.
Right.
Unfortunately, at the same time, he was, as you pointed out, passing along what are really recognized now to be terrible myths. And one of the best things that I really want to stress to students and also to anyone who's listening who has an interest in the Crusades, is that the last 30 or 40 years has seen a kind of revolution among scholars regarding the Crusades, in that the old idea that the Crusades were wars of unprovoked aggression against a generally peaceful Islamic world, that the Crusaders set off only for rapacious purposes, that they wanted to capture land and wealth, and that they waged crusades against the Jewish population, that apologies should be made for the crusades. And then you can even get into the technical things like only second sons of nobles went off to the crusades, which now is not true. All of these myths have been really attacked and completely demolished by a whole new generation of scholars.
Right.
One can think, for example, of Jonathan Riley Smith, of other really gifted scholars today. And they're doing important work, I think, because while people like Terry Jones, for entertainment purposes and because of their own biases, tend to advance and continue to advance a lot of these myths, on the academic level, especially in modern medieval studies in England, we're seeing great progress being made in helping to get the word out. Now, whether that's ever going to trickle down, I don't know. But I would encourage people to read a lot of the more recent studies by a lot of these authors. For example, one that comes to mind is Professor Thomas Madden, an associate professor at the Department of History at St. Louis University, who has written extensively on the subject of the way that people misrepresent and distort the true history of the Crusades. So the truth is out there if we just look for it. And if we can get the word out, and that's why I'm very grateful for shows like yours and helping people to do that.
I think it's something so important for today because a lot of the misconceptions we have about Islam, somehow the Crusades keep popping back up and how we were out to destroy them from the very beginning.
And that's one of the things, too, why context is so important. The Crusades were not launched as a terrible offensive war that one day Pope Urban II in 1095 woke up and decided, well, I'm going to bring about a massive undertaking of modern Christendom to go and invade the Middle East and destroy Islam. What was actually happening at the time was that the long-cherished places of the Holy Land that had been lost to the Arab armies in the 7th and 8th century were under attack. They had been occupied for almost 400 to 500 years, but the pilgrim trails that had been allowed for a number of centuries were falling under attack from the Seljuk Turks, a wild, nomadic, and fanatical Islamic people. And it's also easy to forget that as late as 1009, for example, the Jerusalem itself had been cut off to Christians, and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre had been destroyed by one of its Islamic overlords. So Christianity, or what was left of it, at a time when Christians were the majority population still in the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
The Christian faith was under assault, as was the Byzantine Empire. So the Crusades were not an offensive war. Rather, they were called in a desperate effort on the part of the Byzantine Empire of the time, and also Blessed Pope Urban II, to mount an effort to save the Christians of Palestine, of the Holy Land, from the real dire threat that they were under from the Seljuk Turks and others. So it was, by medieval terms, a clearly just war. It was an undertaking that was tolerated under what was then understood to be the just war theory.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a defensive effort to try to save the pilgrim trails to end the tyranny that was going on there. It was not then some colonial effort. It wasn't a war of aggression. It was actually a war intended to save people. Now, we can look at it from with modern eyes and say, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. But, in fact, many wars have been launched even in the modern age for that same purpose.
And it's also a naive impression we have of the precepts of what it is to be Muslim. Help me out if I start to stretch it too much. But they have an understanding of there is an abode of Islam and abode of war. And anything that is not Islam is war. So in that conquering mentality is something, especially in those earlier years, if not still today, I mean, that was a driving force in their need to conquer areas.
Well, Islam is traditionally divided into what is called the House of War and the House of Islam.
Okay.
And the House of Islam is comprised of all of those regions that are under Islamic control or have embraced the Islamic faith. And the House of War refers to pretty much everything else.
Right.
And the very language of that, I think, gives us a good idea of at least how many Muslims interpret that there has to be an ongoing struggle in order to bring about the entire world within the House of Islam. It's easy to forget that for those who are Christians, for those who are Jews, those who are Hindus, who live and historically have lived under Islamic rule, they are subject to a variety of legal, social, and political disabilities. And they are forced as well to pay what is called the jizya, which is a poll tax. And that varies from place to place and has varied in its severity. But at times, the things like the jizya and the status of non-Muslims has been very, very severe. And at the time of the Middle Ages, while there were parts of Islam where Christians lived essentially unmolested, conditions were deteriorating rapidly for many Christians in the areas of the Seljuk Turks. It's also important to remember that there were Muslims who welcomed the arrival of some of the Crusader armies because they too were threatened by the fanatical Seljuk Turks.
Mm-hmm.
So at times there was common cause with the Crusader armies when they arrived in the Holy Land, because they were seen as a strong bulwark against fanatical Muslims threatening to overtake everything.
Mm.
So things, as is usually the case with history and the truth, were a lot more complicated, and they were not quite as white and black as we're often told.
Right.
The Crusaders were not irredeemably evil people, nor at times were the Muslims the good guys in this story. So the things are a lot more complicated.
And there's a real perception that somehow the Christians were trying to force conversion on the Muslims, which was not the case, if I remember correctly.
That's absolutely right. In fact, and this is, I think, one of the most remarkable aspects about the whole history of the Crusades, the Kingdom of Jerusalem that was established in 1099, following the capture of Jerusalem, allowed the free exercise of religion. Jews could worship as they chose. Eastern Orthodox could worship as they chose. Muslims could worship as they chose, as long as they were willing to pay taxes, as long as they were peaceful, as long as they accepted the political structure and the social structure of the time. So they had their own courts, they had their own legal systems, they were allowed to live pretty much anywhere except for Jerusalem, which was considered a holy city. So the freedoms that were offered there were quite remarkable and at times somewhat unusual. So tolerance was the order of the day throughout most of the history of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, contrary to what people hear.
I think it's also important, too, I mean, when we talk about the Crusades, of course, there were a number of them, and there was persecution that occurred to the Jews, especially in the Rhineland, if I recall that correctly. But that was not under the direction of the church. It was a fanatical Cistercian, wasn't it, that kind of got the people geared up, but it was not the directive of the Pope.
That's absolutely correct. As the First Crusade began organizing and galvanizing the people of Christendom to set off, bands of self-proclaimed crusaders in Germany launched terrible persecutions of some of the Jewish population. What is notable in that is that they were condemned by the leaders of the church, including the Pope, and many bishops, clergy, and other lay people actually gave their lives trying to stop the murders and the persecutions. At the time of the Second Crusade, in the middle of the 12th century, another persecution of Jewish populations began, especially in France. And the leader of the opposition to this was St. Bernard of Clairvaux, one of the greatest mystics of the medieval era, who was appalled that the crusade that he had supported so enthusiastically should be perverted in such a way by inauthentic Christians. So he roamed around France and elsewhere and organized with the help of bishops, archbishops, to put an end to this. And he was pretty successful in doing so. So what was going on was the more culturally pervasive and lamentable anti-Semitism of the era, but it was never something that was encouraged by any of the leaders of the church.
I think, again, there are so many misconceptions, just bad information out there concerning the Crusades. Even the number of deaths, though any death would be, especially of innocents, be something that we can't tolerate, the numbers were not as extreme as some have been reporting.
Right. Well, there's a an old legend that in the wake of the capture of Jerusalem in 1099 by the Crusader armies, former President Bill Clinton even referenced this famous quote from a chronicler of the period, that the massacre was so severe that the blood washed up to the ankles and the bridles of the horses. The reality is very different. We know this by a couple of reasons. One, the actual stories of the severity of the massacres, while noted by a number of the historians who accompanied the crusade, the numbers just kept growing with each retelling on the part of Islamic historians, which is understandable. I mean, at the time, they were waging a propaganda war against the Crusaders. The truth is that most of the population of Jerusalem actually escaped from the city in the chaos following the fall of the city. The number of actual deaths that resulted in the so-called massacre was actually much lower than is generally told, just by the sheer reality of the local population, and also because the number of crusaders was limited. You did not have a very sizable army at the time that actually captured the city. And again, in the chaos that followed, many died from the sheer brutality of just that style of warfare. But, again, we know that the stories about the massacre have been severely exaggerated. The claim, for example, in the 13th century that 70,000 men, women, and children died in this bloodbath is dismissed today by every serious scholar. Did a massacre take place? Unfortunately, yes, there were severe brutalities that occurred. But again, we have to look at the wider context. This was the style of warfare of the period, and Muslims perpetrated massacres, Christians perpetrated massacres. That was what happened in medieval warfare. Is it something that we can condone today? Absolutely not. But we have to understand that that was the time. It was a very violent age, which is why the church tried so hard with programs such as the Truth of God and the Peace of God to help bring about a gentler form of warfare, one that was more consistent with the gospel, and also one that helped to bring knights, who by their nature were pretty violent people, more into the Christian life. And that was a tall undertaking, but it was one that the church never really gave up on during the Middle Ages.
Would you say that might be the place of origin for that chivalry type of mantle that knights would take upon themselves?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You can look right throughout the Middle Ages, from really the 9th century on. The stress that is placed on chivalry and combat, the paladin, the knight who tries to lead a perfectly virtuous life, who protects the innocent, who defends the weak, who will die for what the Christian Church demands. And you can see that in the Truth of God, you can see that in the Peace of God, as I was saying, these specific programs to help knights to become better people. And this entire chivalric tradition became one of the hallmarks of the Middle Ages, and is really, I think, one of the most eloquent parts of medieval lore and medieval literature. Why King Arthur was so beloved is because he and his knights were examples of knightly virtue and trying to live as ideal Christian knights in what was a very violent world.
And again, this is a complicated issue, and we look back on this history. Would it be fair to say that had they had not responded, if Pope Urban had originally not responded, and even the following crusades, whether they were successful or not, they essentially stopped Islamic expansion into Europe during the Middle Ages, which allowed the rise of the university systems to flourish, that time of reason, that time of, you know, great cultural expansion in the West to occur. If Islamic expansion had not been checked by those crusades, we may be looking at a completely different world now.
Very much so. If we trace the events that followed, the rise of the Ottoman Turks, the Crusades helped to prevent the invasion of Europe for a number of centuries. The Ottoman Turks, who became the successors to the Seljuk Turks, really brought the war directly to Europe. And what followed then is almost 500 years of near total Ottoman domination across the Mediterranean, marching all the way to the gates of Vienna. It's mm-hmm. easy to forget just how under threat Christian Europe was. Mm-hmm. And they were turned back in a series of battles, of course, the most famous being the Battle of Lepanto in 1521. And what you have is exactly what you were just saying, that the bulwark of Christianity, of Christendom, held at bay the conquest of Europe for centuries until such a time that the Ottoman Empire was no longer vital enough or strong enough to wage an effective war and began sinking under the weight of its own cultural decay and corruption. But that the real legacy of the Crusades was not just that the Ottoman Turks were defeated, but exactly what you were saying as well, the travel and communication networks, trade, science, literature, all of these things benefited from that remarkable interaction that took place between the Christian West and the Islamic East. But let's not also forget the access that the Crusades gave to traders through the Byzantine Empire, through the ports of Egypt, through Damascus, through Jerusalem, to the silks and the ivory, the spices, the cloth from the Silk Road, mm-hmm. Far East. Europe became a much more colorful, much more diverse, much more interesting, and much more enlightened place because of the Crusades. So for anyone who says that the Crusades simply brought wholesale chaos, destruction, and war, that simply isn't the case, and history has proven otherwise.
Fascinating.
The other thing, of course, is that we were noting that largely through the campaigns of what's called the Reconquista in Spain, when what had been the Islamic-controlled Iberian Peninsula passed once more into the hands of the Christians through an almost 500-year effort. Because of the long-lost translations of Aristotle and other great philosophers, it had really the most far-reaching consequences for the future of Christian thought and, as you noted, the development of universities. So the West and the great patrimony of the intellectual tradition of the Enlightenment and other things would not have developed in the way that it did had it not been for the effort of common Christians, of common Christian knights, of men and women who gave their lives for a cause that they knew was greater than themselves.
Wow. Yeah. So much more. There's such a depth to all of the stories of the various Crusades. I just encourage folks to go to Catholic Distant University on the internet and take part in the seminar, either for graduate credit, undergrad credit, or even just as a seminar to be able to be a participant to essentially audit it through Dr. Matthew Bunsen. How fascinating.
I'm looking forward to giving the seminar, and hopefully we'll be offering it again in the near future. In the meantime, there are quite a few books that you can find online, at Amazon and elsewhere, of course, on this very topic. You look for Jonathan Riley Smith, you look for Thomas Madden, two really excellent writers. If you want to learn more about the topic.
And I'm looking forward to your A&E special on the Crusades.
I think not in our lifetime, but things
never say never.
Never say never.
Okay. Well, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, we want to thank you so much for being with us today. We really appreciate it, as always. Before we wrap up today, any final thoughts, either on the appointment of a new Superior General for the Jesuits or the Crusades conversation that we had this hour? It's been fascinating.
I think one of the things that we always have an obligation as Catholics, as believers, that we're always searching for the truth, whether that truth is known to our neighbors or not. But the more that we know about what really went on in history and the more that we can proclaim the gospel authentically and the truth of history, I think the stronger we'll be as Catholics, but also the more lives we can touch in bringing the truth about things to people. That's an obligation that we all have.
Amen.
Amen
well
to
said.
That. Dr. Matthew Bunsen, again, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it. We look forward to our next conversation, which I hope will not be too long from right now.
Thank you, and God bless.